Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. 2020 has been a bleak and barren year for International Rugby League. In fact, the only international match that's been played has been between Germany and the Netherlands. So this week's episode aims to rekindle memories by looking back at the great 1986 Kangaroo Tour of Britain, a tour that confirmed Australia's dominance of the game on the pitch and cemented its leadership off it, something which continues to grow to the present time. And to join me in looking back at that 1986 tour is Mark Flanagan, author of The Invincibles, the inside story of the 1982 Kangaroos, the team that changed rugby forever, which we talked about in episode 73 of Rugby Reloaded. The 1986 tour was called The Return of the Invincibles, so I guess that this episode should be called The Return of the Invincibles author. So, welcome back to the podcast, Mark.
Thank you, Tony. Yeah, it's great to be back.
Well, I suppose let's start by recapping that 1982 tour, because that set everything up. So for those listeners who haven't heard haven't read your book, which they should do, or haven't heard the earlier episode, just give us a brief outline of the tour and the importance of the events on that tour.
Yes, certainly. Well, I think the significant thing really was the lasting effect that that tour had on rugby in Great Britain and around the world. At that point, you know, rugby league in this country was a pretty low ebb. The standards had dropped off. Britain had lost badly in Australia in 79, having beat Australia at Bradford at Oddsall, the famous Dad's Army game in 78. So in the 70s, I think most people realised that the gap was starting to widen. But that gap between 79 and then them coming in 82... we didn't really know much about this young team that Frank Stanton was bringing over. And in terms of what had been happening in Australia, in terms of developing the players, using weight machines, using video analysis, none of which happened in Great Britain at that time. You know, the guys were training twice a week, three times a week if they were lucky. One of the players that I interviewed for the book talked about, you know, you go training, you go for a lot of drinks. Train on Thursday, go for a lot of drinks. Play on Sunday, go for a lot of drinks. And the sort of talent stream that had come through by 82 meant that Great Britain was not in a particularly good place. That was compounded by the fact that Australia, unbeknownst to most people in this country, were in a particularly strong place and brought over a lot of brilliant young players. Most of them had come through the Jack Gibson Parramatta system. So Peter Sterling and Brett Kenny were 21, 22. But we still didn't know much about them. We'd seen Les Boyd in 78, a couple of the other forwards in 78. And then, obviously, the first game at Hull KR, it was reasonably close. But as the next few games building up to the first test started, I think it became fairly obvious to most people who knew a lot about rugby league that we were seeing something that we'd really never seen before in terms of the pace, the power, the intensity, the skill. The old adage that Australian players were fitter, British players were more skillful, was then blown apart by what happened at the first test at Boothroyd Park as possibly the most one-sided test we've ever seen in this country, bearing in mind the penalty count, which I think a lot of people forget. I mean, Britain were handed a lot of opportunities, but looked so insipid in attack. Every time the Aussies got the ball, they threw the ball around. They were so powerful that they had, you know, Mel Meninga in the centre, who was probably the heaviest player on the pitch almost, but was as fast as any of the Great Britain backs were. And they were so well organised, so well drilled. Britain never got a sniff. And that set the tone then, and it was a rude awakening for British rugby league, and that they won every game. You know, the third test was a bit closer, but by that point it was all over. The second test they were just as dominant, conceded so few points. I mean, the stats are astonishing. You know, during the whole tour of Great Britain and France, to pile up 1,005 points and only concede 120 when it was 3 points for a try was just, you know, difficult to get your head round. And the powers that be in Great Britain decided that was the final straw and things had to change. So what happened on the back of 82, foreign players came in. Committees didn't pick the team for Great Britain after 82. The training methods that had been developed in Australia by the likes of Jack Gibson, who used American football as a template, started to come in. Mal Reedy came in at Castleford, built a weight room at Castleford, and all that really happen because of the Invincibles in 82.
Yeah, and I think there was still a sense in British Rugby League that perhaps this was just cyclical and that eventually things would come back to parity. But those hopes were dashed somewhat by the 1984 Lions tour to Australia, where, again, Great Britain were completely whitewashed. Can you say something about the 1984 tour? That was kind of a bridge between the two Kangaroo tours, wasn't it?
Yeah, the 84 tour was you know, an interesting one, because the thing about 82 is, when you look at the players that were picked, there was no star quality in the Great Britain team. Frank Stanton, when I interviewed him for the book, talked about he could have picked six different teams from Australia and all would have beaten any team that Great Britain put up in 82. And likewise, whatever John Whiteley and Colin Hutton and the selectors decided in 82, they were all so much of a muchness. Whereas the arrival of Schofield, the arrival of Handy, you know, Glee Crooks was 2 years older after making his debut in 82. Andy Gregory looked like a star in the making as well at the halfback. So 84 was the start of this golden generation coming through for Great Britain. Joe Lydon went on the 84 tour, and Kevin Ward as well was starting to really blossom under the tutelage of Mal Reilly at Castleford. So we finally had players who may have got into the Australia team. And the other thing about 84, which was really interesting, was the politics in Australia. Queensland had won the state of origin. So when the Australia team was announced for the first test in 84, many of the British people were scratching their heads thinking, where's X, where's Y? It was packed full of Queenslanders. Peter Stirling wasn't in the team. Many of the New South Wales stars of 82 weren't there. And I think that helped Great Britain, because they weren't a cohesive outfit as they were in 82. Frank Stanton was the coach. So he was also the coach of New South Wales. So there were problems in the Australia dressing room. However, the gap was still sizable. The other thing as well, I think, you know, the first test was played on a terrible playing surface from memory. It'd just been used for a football game a few days earlier, bone hard pitch. It wasn't conducive to playing good rugby league. The scores were closer in the test matches. But still, even though the Australians were in relative disarray, if you can call it that, all things are relative. We weren't getting that close to them. I think also as well that the 84 tour, people who went on the 84 tour from Great Britain, it was a really poorly organised tour. The famous story about them being thrown off a training ground so some bank employees could play at lunchtime, sort of gone down into folklore, I think, among some of the players. The players were left to fend for themselves from an eating perspective. There wasn't any team bonding. There were lots of injured players who were just hanging around. I think by the time they got to New Zealand, they'd picked a massive 30-man squad. And by the final test, there were 13 injured players just sort of hanging around. They weren't sent home. So all those things didn't help as well. And you know, it's a tour that was captained by Brian Noble. He was only 23. I think Brian Noble ended up having to do a lot of the dirty work in terms of telling players they were dropped. So things like that went on. And they ended up losing all six test matches, three in Australia, three in New Zealand. But we did see the green shoots of recovery, and particularly people like Schofield. And obviously, you know, what Hanley had done at Bradford, and then subsequently went on to do at Wigan, he fulfilled all his potential. So we did have players who could match the Australian players in certain positions, but we were still, I think, quite a long way away, particularly from a defensive perspective. You know, people talk about the great players like Wally Lewis and Peter Stirling and Brett Kenny in terms of what they could do in attack. But if you watch them during games closely, how brilliant they are defensively, how brave they are, how clever they are, how brilliant tacklers they are. All three of those players that I've just mentioned are fantastic tacklers. So we still had a long way to go in terms of getting the game structure right and being able to kind of outthink as well as outfight the Australians.
Although the 84 tour was hugely disappointing and kind of demonstrated that things wouldn't just get back to parity by just through natural selection of natural process. But it did lay the basis for the 1985 series against New Zealand when the New Zealand tourists came over here. And New Zealand had a really good side at that point. They defeated Australia, and Great Britain managed to draw the series and could easily have won the series. And again, as you say, it was players like Schofield who scored 4 tries in the second Test match, Hanley, Gregory, who really came to the fore against the 85 Kiwis. And that kind of gave people possibly a false sense of optimism when the 86 Kangaroos came over.
Yeah, and I think in terms of what was happening domestically in the clubs was important as well. The influx of Australians and Kiwis into the British game helped. Attendances were on the rise. Wigan were a club particularly who seemed to be getting their house in order. They were buying up the best players. The likes of Hanley, Lydon, went to Wigan in the build-up to 86. And I think the tone was set in terms of the feel-good factor, certainly amongst the fans, in that first game at Wigan. You know, the crowd was 30,500, which was the highest ever for a tour match involving Wigan, a time where socially, economically, the country wasn't doing particularly well, and particularly their soccer cousins, things weren't going well as well. But rugby league seemed to be getting things right in that perspective. And certainly the way that Wigan performed in that first tour match, the Aussies, they eventually ran out 26-18 winners, but they got a hell of a fright. And I think that also buoyed the optimism of the British public. And I think also what was happening at the RFL, they were getting their house in order in terms of marketing the game right. They take a bold step in terms of hosting that first Test match at Old Trafford.
I think you're right. There's there was a greater sense of optimism about the game, and in a sense, it was that mid 80s period from the 82 tour onwards. It was really the beginning, despite the bad performance of Great Britain, it was really the beginning of the resurgence of British Rugby League at that time. That leading all the way up to the establishment of the Super League in 96, and as you say, the transformation of Wigan under Maurice Lindsay, and they became the first full-time professional squad. Massive rise in crowds, the success of the two Hull teams. It was really a boom time for the club game. And by the time that the 86 Kangaroos came, there was a real sense of optimism, as you said. The fact that that was shown in the fact that Wigan could draw 30,000 people to that opening game, and they ran the Australians close. And I think as the Test matches approached, there was a great sense of optimism, and David House and David Oxley at the RFL did a great job in showing some vision and booking Old Trafford for the first Test match, which was almost sold out, well over 50,000 people there on a terrible wet day. But it didn't quite work out, did it, at the match?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other kind of thing to remember about in the build-up to 86 was the 85 Challenge Cup final as well. The whole Wigan game, a lot of people tell you the greatest game they've ever seen, gloriously sunny day, 100,000 at Wembley. And I think the contrast between that and what was happening in soccer was stark. And I think, the national profile of the game was massive. By the time the Aussies, stepped off the plane in 86. So it was a time of event rugby league where it was making headlines, not just in the heartlands, but across the country. And that game, that Challenge Cup final in 85, really was cemented its place as a proper national sport, which was, had probably superseded, rugby union as a club thing was pretty disorganised back then. And rugby league felt like, the sport, the up and coming sport. And, we had the Aussies coming in 86, the perfect time. However, as good as Wigan did in that first game, the next game at Hull KR, 46-10. Leeds were crushed 40-0 at Headingley. The Cumbrians were crushed 48-12. So those who would be following the games closely could possibly see, as good, we may have improved, but how close are we? And obviously the first test at Old Trafford proved once again just how good they were. I mean, the thing about that game once again reinforced the importance of the detail, the kind of making every tackle, the structure of defence. We had players who could break the line, and lots of Great Britain players in that first test broke tackles and great handoffs, players backing up. Kevin Ward was fantastic, making lots of busts. We just still couldn't quite organise ourselves, you know, at the other end of the pitch. And obviously, when you've got a team who had Mal Meninger and Terry Lamb sitting on the bench, you're talking about four players in the centre of the pitch playing at their pomp: Gene Miles, Brett Kenny, Wally Lewis, Peter Sterling, all 26, 27, four of the greatest players ever to play the game, who were able to, you know, run the show. And when things got a little bit hairy, you had Peter Sterling, probably the greatest football brain. You had Wally Lewis, probably the greatest player. Brett Kenny, arguably the greatest centre the game's ever seen, who just had that edge. And it was actually quite interesting as well in the run-up to the first test that the Australian press had really got stuck into the Australian forwards. One of the Australian journalists had coined them pussycats. So people like Roy Simmons, who then went on to coach Hull, Steve Roach and Noel Cleal, who came back to Hull, they had a point to prove in that game. Interestingly as well, Wayne Pearce hadn't made the tour. The star, many people consider him the star of 82. That happened in controversial circumstances. Pearce had got himself fit and gone for a 10-mile run on the eve of his official medical with the ARL. But the Australian doctor deemed himself not to be fit. Likewise, Eric Groth as well. He was controversially left out, and there was a little bit of a concern that certain club teams were being favoured over other club teams. The anti-Parramatta factor, I think, a lot of people considered it in Australia. So there were controversies running up to the tour, and I think, you know, the wingers weren't outstanding, didn't have the X factor like they did in 82, but in those four players that I just mentioned, they just had the know-how and the skill just to oversee victories. Great Britain was so clearly much better than they were in 82. I mean, if you watch the 82 tests and the 86 tests, they are chalk and cheese. In 82, it was frankly embarrassing watching Great Britain trying to attack the Australian line, whereas in 86, they did it with a lot of purpose. There were plans. They were clearly being drilled in attack to a point where they could cause the Aussies problem. But yeah, there's still a long way to go.
One of the things that people forgot at the time was that, sure, British rugby league had developed a lot in those previous 4 years, but so did the Australians. The Australian game had gone on in leaps and bounds. I remember going to the second match of the tour against Hull KR. Rovers were never in it. Remember, they were the cup finalists. They'd done pretty well in the league that previous season, but they were just blown away. And I remember coming away and people saying, well, these guys are better than the 82 tourists. And I think when you look at this Old Trafford test match, and there's that fantastic try by Joe, length of the field try by Joe Lydon, but Great Britain were never in it. They could come back at times, and in the second half they scored, you know, Schofield, I think, scored a couple. But essentially, it was no different from 4 years previously. As you said, Britain were better organised, they had better players, but ultimately, when it came down to stepping up to a high level, the Australians had another gear, and we didn't. But one of the interesting things is that Maurice Bamford was the coach of the 86 team, and he brought something, he brought a certain charisma to the role of coach that really hadn't existed. And this is no disrespect to Johnny Whiteley in 82 or Frank Meyer in 84. But Maurice was a different type of coach, and he led from the front. He was a personality. And that did seem to have something of an impact on the team as well. You know, as I say, he led from the front and the team did follow.
I think that, you know, Maurice was incredibly proud to have the job. He put his heart and soul into it. He got better support than Johnny did in 82, and certainly Frank Myler would have got in 84. And behind the scenes, Phil Larder was helping Maurice, so Maurice could concentrate on doing what Maurice was good at in terms of getting the players going and instilling that sense of the importance of it and the motivation thing. And I think he really, really believed that they had a really good chance of doing it. I mean, he famously went into the dressing room after that first test and told the players, that he was going to pick the same team because he'd invested so much into them. I mean, in hindsight, I think he probably would not have done the same thing. But after all the seesawing of 82, one of the things that the great British authorities wanted to do was, you know, in 82, after the first test, there were 10 changes. After the second test, there were 10 changes. You couldn't carry on like that. It was ridiculous. So the reaction to what happened in 82 was, we're going to try and pick a team and stick with it. And you've got to admire him for that. And you know, in some respects, he was on the right lines. But to tell them straight away that, you know, they were all going to get picked wasn't maybe the smartest move. The other thing, I think, in 86, Hanley wasn't quite fit. Hanley didn't play in the second test. He was injured, so they had to rejig things. And I think what happened in the second test, which I would argue is the greatest display of international rugby I've ever seen. I mean, for the first 30 minutes, Elland Road, Great Britain had a right go, but they never got really close to the Australia line. They played some great stuff in the middle of the park, and the Australian defence was so fantastic. I mean, this thing about when we talk about great performances, so much of what we're concentrating is in attack, whereas we should be really appreciating the defence. The Australian defence for that first half, it was just an absolute lesson and it should be shown to every rugby league team. And then in the second half, put a demonstration of attack, which I've never seen the like of which before. The way they played was just extraordinary. And I think what really got to Morris was the fact that the chance of what a load of rubbish from certain sections of the crowd, which I think really badly affected him. And I think that actually was a sense of frustration that we'd done so well, inverted commas, in the first 30 minutes and looked really good, but not being able to get over the line. And I think that what a load of rubbish was because a lot of people in the crowd did feel like we had a chance, but were then, oh, same old story. And that's where the chance started coming from. And I think Morris took it to mean, you've picked the Britain are still, you know, the players are still rubbish, you're rubbish. And he took the defeat really badly. He was a bit, I think he was a bit broken afterwards as well.
I think you're right, though, because that was, I mean, that, because I was at that match, I remember the first 25, 30 minutes, you know, very optimistic. And then the last 10 minutes, in a way that happened regularly, Great Britain just fell away and Australia came and scored. And then it was that sort of massive sense of deflation. And we're just doing the same thing again. And so there was a lot of booing at halftime when the players came off. In a sense, because people in the crowd didn't understand what had actually happened on the pitch. So it all came out. And you can see that had a massive effect on the team. And, you know, it was, as you say, it was a great performance by Australia. But it was also a terribly deflating defeat after all the raised expectations that there'd been in the game, really since that drawn series against the Kiwis in 85.
Yeah, and I suppose it's easier for us in hindsight to understand, you know, when you're trying to close a gap as big as it was in 82, you've got to do it in steps, and you can't go from 0 to 60 in the blink of an eye. That's what British rugby league had to do because they were so far behind. But I think, you know, for the astute watchers in the crowd, they could see that, my goodness, this was a hell of a lot better than 82. Bearing in mind, obviously, we're at 4 points for a try now as well. So even though, you know, it was 34-4 in the second test, the third test was close, 24-15, 38-16 in the first test. Adding 4 points for a try, I mean, Lee Crooks didn't have a great kicking performance as well, as well as he played with the ball in hand. I mean, he was one of the star players for Great Britain. Hanley had a quiet series. Kevin Ward really came to the fore. But we still, things like the kicking game, you know, the kicking game is massive in rugby league. You know, I remember watching in that second test, there's a point where Lewis is running with the ball. He's inside his own half. He's not running at full speed, but he hits this 70-yard grubber kick, if he can hit a 70-yard grubber kick, and it stops a foot from the dead ball line. Well, when you've got players like Sterling and Lewis, who not only can do it, but know when to do it, those things make a massive difference. There was a couple of times in the second test when clearly the players have been told to keep up the pace and keep up the intensity and were taking taps from when they're in the half, when they got a penalty, when they could have kicked for touch and taken, you know, they could have been 40 yards further up the pitch and then reset themselves and played the game in Australia's half where they were trying to run from deep. And you've got to admire the courage and in, from that respect, but it just seemed a little bit naive. And I think that's the thing in 86, that we were still a bit naive from that perspective. We had players who could excite us and go round players in the great ride and try, which, funnily enough, came on the back of about 7 penalties in a row that Great Britain had been awarded. So we should have scored as well. Great to do it in that manner. But, you know, when you've been awarded, I think they ended up 8 penalties in a row in the second half in that game. So, those are the times you've got to take advantage. And it came back to 16-10, but then what happens 2 minutes later? Wally Lewis crosses, and all the excitement. And watching back those games, you can feel the excitement in the ground, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck, the roars from the crowd. Great seeing those packed stadiums. And I think from my perspective, you know, as looking back at it as something of a historian, looking back at those times, it does feel still quite exciting that we were so much better than 82. And you could see real genuine progress being made, even though obviously the 86 Australians matched what the 82 team did in terms of winning every game.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that they did as well, which, again, you forget about in hindsight, the games against club sides were, aside from the Wigan game, and to some extent Oldham, who ran them close, were all massive victories for the Kangaroos in a way that a lot of club matches weren't in 82. And in some of the club matches, like, for example, against Hull, and even Hull KR, the Kangaroos were on the back foot for to some extent. But in 86, as I say, apart from Wigan and Oldham, they just blasted through. And certainly on the second half of the tour, I don't think any club side scored a try against them. So that was another indication of how they'd stepped up their game over the previous 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, the two games in the run-up to the last test, 48-0 against Hull, 38-0 against Bradford. And that just shows still as well, obviously, Ferner, who was the Aussie coach, was mixing and matching his team. They didn't play as many games, so it wasn't quite that workload that they had in 82, but it was still pretty intense. But just showed, obviously, that's the thing, the strength in depth, which Australia had. I mean, if you think of some of the players who didn't get in that team in Australia, even someone like, you know, Gavin Miller, who went to Hull KR, I mean, you'll know, Tony, I mean, You know, I worked in Hull for quite a long time and went to quite a lot of Rovers games when I was there. You talk to people who watch Rovers in the 80s, they'll tell you Gavin Miller was the best player they had since Millwall. But sort of like Phil Vivas at St Helens. They just had so many players of a standard. And that was the thing in terms of the gap that we've never really closed, is just it is their national sport. They do have more players playing the game. They're obviously going to have more players in that level, you know, international level, which is going to produce superstars, because there's just going to be that few more players who are even better than the likes of Gavin Miller and Phil Vivas and all the other players who are stellar. But when you're talking about a tour, when you're going on a tour, if you've got 30 players and they're all of a certain standard, that's why you start producing results like you did at Bradford and Hull. And why, on the flip side, we couldn't quite reciprocate that in terms of blowing away the Australian club teams and state teams in 84 and 88.
And so we get to the final test where Great Britain actually get within a try of almost taking the lead in the match. And really close, really exciting. But again, it's Wally Lewis who comes to rescue the Kangaroos at the end. And it ends another 3-0 whitewash by the Kangaroos.
And he did it on the 7th tackle.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
I think it's interesting in the lead up to the third test, that Britain made 5 changes for the third test. And actually, in research for the book, I was able to discover that Les Bettinson, who was the manager, who was a big step forward as well from a management perspective. Les Bettinson, for people who didn't know him, who played a lot Salford stalwart for many years. In the dark days of the early 80s, he was often the guy calling for the things that happened after 82 in terms of reforming the RFL. You know, he was a big mover in, you know, alongside people like Phil Larder and David Howes and David Oxley. And then when he belatedly got there, he should have been the manager in 84, typical political RFL stuff that went on. Dick Gemmell strangely got the job, who was the manager in 79, the disastrous draw in 79, got it in 84 when Bettinson should have got it. Eventually, Les Bettinson got it in for 86. And he actually admitted that a few of those changes were made to kind of restore public confidence. They didn't want to make that many, but felt that after what happened at Elland Road, that they needed to. So Harry Pinner came in, who was a player who had been struggling with an ankle injury, who was incredibly highly rated by a lot of people in rugby league, but struggled with injury. And then I think critically, Andy Gregory came in as well, who on his day was the match for pretty much anyone in that position. I think Andy Gregory sometimes, you know, in hindsight, would admit he didn't help himself in terms of the way that he kind of spoke or behaved. But as a rugby league player who could make things happen, who at that level you need players with his vision, his skill, his that pace that he had in terms of breaking tackles. And what happened, obviously, in 88 in that final test was kind of indication for the fact that Gregory had talked himself up as a great player in many respects in the years leading up to in 88, but then delivered. And I think in that final test in 86, we saw that, you know, if he could be channeled in the right direction, the energy and the positivity you could get from Andy Gregory, if Andy Gregory didn't beat himself up, you know, almost kind of self-destruct himself, he would be a huge asset to British rugby. And with Hanley and Crooks and Lydon and Henderson Gill and Kevin Ward, you had the basis of a team that could really challenge the Aussies.
Yeah, and I think that's eventually what happened in 88 on the Lions tour in 88. And then really that generation culminated in the 1992 tour to Australia, where Great Britain actually over the three tests, Great Britain actually outscored Australia, but still lost the test series 2-1. And the other thing is that the players that you mentioned, pretty much all of them were successes when they went to play club football in Australia. Obviously, Ellery was, you know, legendary at Balmain, but same with Gary Schofield at Wests and Balmain. Joe Lydon went there. Andy Gregory had a great session at Illawarra. And Kevin Ward, who sadly is somewhat forgotten about today, but was fantastic prop forward and was a star for Manly when they won the 87 Rugby League Grand Final in Australia. So there was a lot of class in that team. And in a sense, you don't really want to say this, but that kind of set the template for Great Britain, or England as it now is, for the future, that there's a core of players who were as good, if not better, than the leading Aussie players, but when it comes to 13 against 13 for 80 minutes, just can't cross the line.
Yeah. You know, I think obviously, you know, in the early 90s, it got as close as it had, or, you know, we may find out soon. If next year, we'll see what happens with the World Cup. But I think the thing was that in 85, Schofield had gone to Balmain, Goodway to Manly. I think Crooks went to Western Suburbs, and Brian Noble went to Cronulla as well. So you had a lot of players who were deemed good enough. And that obviously started a process of players coming backwards and forwards, which was massively beneficial in terms of realising that they could take them on at their own game. I think Kevin Ward is a great example, who was probably a lot of people will say he was the player of the match. He was the best forward in that grand final. So when Mal Reilly came along in 88, who was just what they needed at that time, a player who, you know, was a great player at the age of 40, could bench press more than anybody else in the squad, who if they were doing fitness tests, was as fit as anybody in the squad, who demanded a level of and an intensity that meant that they could match the Aussies. And he was kind of the final piece of the jigsaw in terms of, you know, being able to win against Australia. I do always feel, though, that the kind of the dead rubber thing, as important as it was to win in 88, and, you know, that winning that dead rubber thing, it's, you always kind of have to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. The Aussies had won in 88, but I think it was such an important victory in terms of giving the players the confidence for, you know, in terms of that golden generation who would, you know, lead us forward into the early 90s, where it was a proper contest. Like you said, you know, was it that game you're referring to? Was that when they picked a Wigan pack? I think the whole pack was Wigan.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, the second test in Melbourne, the entire pack was from Wigan, and it was a decisive victory, yeah.
Yeah, 33-10. So, like you say, the Aussies just seemed to be able to find a way just to eke it out. Was it the game at Wembley with a missed pass and a missed tackle? I'm trying to think, was it 94 or 90?
Yeah, the '92 World Cup final.
Steve Renouf, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, where John Devereux missed the tackle on Renouf.
That game, in terms of that's what we want it to be like, on a knife edge. Literally, one mistake is the difference between the teams. I suspect we're not there anymore. The sadness is obviously what's happened with Super League in terms of making tours very difficult. We can have internationals, but there is something special about the tours. And in terms of doing the book, the one sad thing I think now is, you know, we're never really going to see a tour like we had in 86 and 82. And those were, you know, were great days for fans of clubs. You know, can you imagine now if an Aussie team toured and played Hull and played St Helens? And it would be fantastic for the game.
On that note, which is a kind of bittersweet note, I think, we'll wrap up there because we've run out of time. So I just said, thanks, Matt. That was absolutely fantastic. And I think we'll have to come back and do more on this, because I think these are, you know, both of these episodes have been really interesting about 82 and 86. And I think there's more that can be said, which you were just getting into, about the kind of final days of Lions and Kangaroos tours in the 1990s. So we'll come back and do another episode on the 90s, I think. Just to remind listeners, Mark's book is called The Invincibles, the inside story of the 1982 Kangaroos, the team that changed rugby forever. And it's available from www.feastofsportmedia.net. And if you want to follow Mark on Twitter, his handle is @TheMarkFlanagan. And as I'm sure you know by now, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony, and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find the complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, along with the links for Mark's book and other show notes for this episode. So until next week, thanks for listening.